is George W. Bush and the Long War. What to expect in the first 30 years. Tom, welcome.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be here. It's useful for me to be required to try and think some of these questions through that are on my mind, in addition to the questions about Crazy Horse, which keep me working. Looking out over this group, I'm reassured. I was a little worried. I planned to say a few words about Vietnam. I feared perhaps no one in the audience would remember Vietnam, but I see that's not going to be the case. I'm astounded, in a way, to find myself revisiting that issue in this way at this time after so many years. We're facing a presidential election where one of the principal points under debate, although not openly and deeply talked about, is whether to go in and win or get out. It's an old question we've heard so often before, and I fear that we're going to be hearing it for a long time to come. And I want to talk about that question, what we should expect from it, and what are some of the implications of the situation in which we find ourselves. Everybody reads about this more or less daily, and I am always a little surprised to discover how long I've been reading about it already. We've been at war in Iraq for nearly 5 years. We've been at war in Afghanistan for nearly 7 years. These are already longish wars by American standards. Not really long, not the long war that President Bush has been talking about and that the Pentagon promises we're going to be involved in or fighting for the next generation, but longish, longer than most of our wars, and no end in sight. After the Ohio and Texas primaries, John McCain gave a speech in which he said, "The American people know we can't remake the decision to go to war. We can't afford to lose. We have to win this war." So if McCain were to be elected in November, which is possible, then we know more or less what to expect. He's going to give it a try. He's not going to give up on Iraq. He's going to probably try harder in Afghanistan. And we can be assured that we'll be stuck there for the duration, certainly, of his first term. That's my belief, at any rate. Clinton and Obama have a slightly different view. But not a completely different view. Both of them want to start getting out the first day of their presidency, or at least point the army in a new direction and start talking about withdrawal. But they do not feel the same way at all about Afghanistan. And there, Obama in particular has emphasized that we picked the wrong war to fight. We really should have stayed in Afghanistan and finished up the war that we confronted there before thinking about invading any other countries. And Clinton also feels that Afghanistan can't be abandoned, that we're too deeply committed to walk away from it. So even if Clinton and Obama are elected, the idea that we're going to be leaving these wars behind anytime soon seems remote. The question, to my mind, is urgent after being involved so long, partly because our army is essentially broken and stretched to the limit, and also because of the immense cost of the war. Joseph Stiglitz, who's an economist, has recently published a book and delivered some testimony in Congress where he was talking about the cost of the war, and he had to go to a lot of effort to figure out what it's actually costing, because there's no major effort on the part of the administration to make that clear. And he came up with a figure of about $600 to $700 billion so far actually spent or in the process of being spent this year. And he estimated that the residual cost of the war, if we were to stop here, would add another $1 trillion on top of that, and possibly another $2 trillion. So we're talking about one of the most expensive endeavors in American history. And after 5 years in Iraq and 7 years in Afghanistan, I don't think anyone could point to those wars there, those countries, and say we'd achieved something large, significant, enduring, and important that would be remotely on a scale with the expenditure we've already undertaken. So if we're not looking forward to getting out of this war anytime soon, how long are we looking forwards towards war and more war and ever greater expense? And the thing that always worries me the most, maybe not the most, but worries me a lot, is the increasingly bitter political debate that I would expect to unfold in the United States, which I'm sure everybody remembers. If they remember anything about Vietnam, they remember that. It was a time when people could hardly speak to each other. And the lines were drawn so clearly and so starkly that a political conversation was always just one step away from physical blows. How long? President Bush, not too long ago, was asked that question, and he said, well, we might be involved in the Middle East for 50 years. And shortly afterwards, a journalist asked John McCain how long he thought it might be, and what did he think about the president's estimate of 50 years? And McCain said, in what I think has become a kind of a McCain way, make it 100. And he hurried to say that we've had troops in a lot of places for a long time. And when he says make it 100, he doesn't mean 100 of continual fighting and killing and dying. And the two are not exactly the same. The killing and the dying are somewhat different. But he meant make it 100 after we win. First, you got to actually win the war. He's not in favor of a 100-year war. He's in favor of a 100-year effort or American presence to secure the peace and establish a world order after we win, if we can win. So that's a question we are again confronting of a sort that we've seen in the past. Can we win? Can we win in Iraq? Can we win in Afghanistan? And I just putting the question makes me feel that we've made the same mistake twice. It's incredible in one lifetime that we could have done exactly the same thing twice, which I take to be the commission of the military error. And the military error, in my mind, is to turn a frustrating political conflict into a military conflict, hoping for a decisive result. And in Vietnam, we took a frustrating political conflict over the control of the of Indonesia and the dissolution of the French Empire, and we turned it into a military question, and the history of it is well known. Everybody can remember how that unfolded, more or less. And the military conflict, whether the political conflict ever could have been resolved with political means, I do not know. But it was certainly apparent that the military conflict could not be resolved by military means by us. It was resolved by military means by the other side, by the North Vietnamese. So I feel that we have committed the military error. We have chosen to use the military to resolve what we see as a frustrating problem in the hope of getting a decisive result. My feeling is that we should have listened to France in the 1960s. We should have listened to Russia in the 1990s. The French had long experience in Vietnam and had much to teach us, which we were not in a mood to learn. And we paid close attention to the Russians and contributed mightily to their own defeat in Afghanistan, although we didn't actually defeat them ourselves. There was a lot to learn there about what not to do. And it's my feeling, my impression, that we didn't learn any of it. We plunged ahead into exactly the kind of war that Americans dislike the most, like the least, wars that involve a lot of killing, which is distressing to us, not to mention destructive to the opponent, and too much dying. One of the things that's interesting about this war that we're in Iraq at the moment is that the political consequences of having 4,000 Americans killed in 5 years is not so different from the consequences of having 50,000 Americans killed in 5 years. In other words, when we're actually watching Americans being killed for what does not appear to be a clear reason without a hope of a clear result or a useful outcome, it's distressing and upsetting and extremely disturbing to our politics. Although at the moment, in the middle of the presidential campaign. It seems quiet, but I anticipate that that will not last long. So too much killing, too much dying, and no decision, just more war. Each new campaign, each battle, however victorious in a short-term sense or however triumphant, always seems to lead to more and get us nowhere. If we think about what the United States did in Vietnam, just bring it back to mind, we basically fought there for 10 years. I mean, you can time it in many different kinds of ways. You can come up with different figures. You could say we started at a different time and ended at a different time, but I say 10 years, 65 to 75. That's roughly right. During that time, we killed 1 million Vietnamese. That's the figure that I've often read. It's obvious that nobody was counting. Nobody was making a serious effort to really know. But serious people who cared tried, and that's the rough figure they came up with, 1 million Vietnamese. In the course of those 10 years, the United States walked over every inch of Vietnam, I would imagine, and they occupied every inch for at least a night or two. And wherever they were in control, and they probably controlled at least a few hundred yards around their perimeter and maybe a mile or two, without ever being challenged in that place as long as they remained. But they took that local control, that security with them, just like a bubble, and moved that bubble around the country, leaving behind the situation as before once they were out of sight. And at the end of the 10 years, as we all, I'm sure, remember, the United States controlled basically the roof of the U.S. Embassy in Saigon, and then the next day we didn't even control that. So 10 years, killed 1 million people, lost 55,000. I mean, what did we get from that? What was that all about? What was that for? That's the thing that astonishes me to reflect. We're embarked on doing again, differently, different enemy, different course of the war, but I anticipate not too different an outcome. What did Russia do in Afghanistan? We were in Vietnam for 10 years. Russia, they should have listened to us. They should have paid some attention to what we did in Vietnam. But they went into Afghanistan, and they fought for 9 years, and they killed 1 million Afghans. 1 million seems to be the number at which the killing country backs off. But they killed 1 million Afghans, and they drove 4 million Afghans into exile. I think it was 4 million, maybe more. And they also walked over every inch of the country and landed their helicopters all over the place and controlled various spots from one day to the next. But when they went away, that control went away with them. And at the end of the 9 years, they had nothing, and the Soviet army, such as remained, they had 100,000 men there, crossed the friendship bridge into Tajikistan, and the war was over, and they had nothing to show for that. I mean, nothing that you could point to, nothing anybody would say made sense. I had an interesting conversation once in Moscow with a guy named Prokhorov, and I think his first name was Alexander, but I'm not sure. And it was very surprising, to me, very surprising. Prokhorov was a big fan of the Russian war in Afghanistan. This was still during the middle of the war. I think it was about 83. And he told me why they were in Afghanistan. And he listed all the reasons why they were in Afghanistan. And every single one of those reasons that he gave was for the betterment of the Afghan people. First of all, they were going to liberate Afghan women. Then they were going to get rid of feudal land-owning structures. And then they were going to educate all the people and teach them to read, and they were going to get rid of oppressive religious systems. I mean, he listed all these things, the very high-minded things that they were doing in Afghanistan while they were killing the 1 million people. And I was astonished. I thought he would have some kind of a hard-headed Cold War geopolitical strategic notion of why they had to control Afghanistan to keep the British from I don't know what, but that wasn't the case. It was all extremely high-minded. And when I think about the Russian experience in Afghanistan, I naturally think about our own extremely excellent reasons for going into Afghanistan ourselves. It's not that nobody cares about that stuff. Is an army the way to do those things? Is an army the way to establish these things that everybody would like? I feel that that's a big part of the military error, the notion that somehow an army can do. Armies can do certain kinds of things, and they're really necessary at certain kinds of times, but not in these kinds of things, not in this sort of war, I don't feel. In January, a new president is going to take office, and I'm presuming that it'll be either McCain or Clinton or Obama, and I don't really have a kind of a gut instinct about who it's going to be at this moment, but whoever it is, they're going to find the same situation. And the same situation is going to be two wars, and both not going well, in some ways going badly. And the biggish war, the one which we think of the most readily when we think of the war at the moment, is the war in Iraq, where by that time, if we stick to the plan, we will have reduced our troop presence to about 140,000 people. And the war there will be 6 years old, and it will have, by my count, four complications. Everybody knows what the four complications are because they've been in the newspaper for the last 5 years in ever clearer and more focused ways. The first one is a sectarian struggle between Sunnis and Shias on religious grounds, but ethnographic grounds and just basic communal strife over control of resources, money, political power, and all the other stuff that people fight about in countries that are on the verge of something like a civil war. So that's the first complication, and it makes things very complicated for us there, not to mention for them. And then the second complication is the surge, which began about a little over a year ago when the president sent 30,000 additional U.S. troops to Iraq. And the surge has had the effect of reducing the level of violence there in a way that obviously makes a huge difference to Iraqis, and especially in Baghdad, where it's been much, much reduced, although the last few days it was noisy. But the surge, at the same time, has complicated the situation another way by creating a new militia, a sort of a U.S.-sponsored Sunni militia of 60 to 80,000 men who are sometimes called the Sons of Iraq and other times called Awakening Councils. And we've essentially hired a lot of people that used to be fighting against us, and we pay them a modest 10 bucks a day or something of that kind, and we've armed them. And they are, in effect, charged with controlling their immediate neighborhoods while they await appointment to the Iraqi National Police or Security Services or the Iraqi military. But as anybody who's been reading the newspaper knows, the Iraqi government, which is largely Shiite in character and run by a Shiite, is extremely reluctant and loath to hire these people and just won't do it, just simply flatly refused to do it. So while the creation of this large U.S.-sponsored militia has reduced the violence in the short term, in the long term, it's a complication that promises further trouble. And if the civil war that's been kind of brewing there and bubbling below the surface should ever break out into the open, it's obvious that this body that we have created will be one of the participants in the civil war and increase the level of violence there very dramatically, I imagine. The third complication in Iraq is that Shia Iran is very close to the Shiite government and to some of the Shiite militias, especially in the southern part of the country. And that has created a situation that troubles the White House and the Pentagon, because we treat Iran as something of an enemy, certainly a rival or an opponent or, from our view, a dangerous and destabilizing element in the Middle East. And the situation that we created is the one that allowed the Shias for the first time in 700 years to actually take control of the country and take control of the country in a sort of democratic way, but a way that promises real control over a long period. And they've already done a lot to change the character of the country. They've moved people around at an incredible rate. Many, many scores of thousands have been moved from one neighborhood to another, and a million or so have left the country as exiles, and perhaps another million or so have moved to a new site within the country. Whole neighborhoods of Baghdad have been transformed and shifted around, so that if you look at an ethnographic map of Baghdad between 2003 and now, the green areas, say, of the Sunnis have shrunk, and the red areas of the Shias have expanded and grown, and the places where you've got a lot of green and red together are fewer and smaller, and that is certainly a complicating factor, and a last complicating factor in Iraq is that we have an open-ended, quite explicit threat on the table to Iran to prevent them from building nuclear weapons. And at the moment, it looks like we've backed away from that, and I know lots of people, including me, were worried for quite a while that despite the shortage of troops and all the other practical reasons for doing nothing, that the administration might, you know, before actually leaving office, make good on its threat not to tolerate a nuclear program in Iran. And I think Bush, on several occasions a couple of years ago, said he would not leave office without having either destroyed or ending the Iranian nuclear program. So that's certainly a complicating factor. Five-year-old war now, 6 years old next January, roughly, approximately 6 years old, and no decision in sight, immense amount of money already spent, large number of troops there, more than the army can comfortably keep there, and a promise of more of the same if you don't actually leave. The second war, the smallish war, is in Afghanistan, where we have 30,000 troops and three complications. But one of those is a really big complication. Starting with a smaller one, I consider it smaller. The United States is trying to fight that war with the help of NATO, and my own feeling is that they'll really break NATO in the process if they insist on going forward. The Russian experience, I think, is sort of typical for countries that decide to invade Afghanistan. 10 years, 100,000 troops, large sum of money, score of 1,000 dead, go home in ignominy and defeat at the end. How do you persuade France and Germany to take on a piece of that? I mean, what would be their point? What would be their goal in doing that? I don't think you can press them to do that. I don't think they will. And if we really and seriously try and press them to do that on that kind of a scale, I think that alliance will be in jeopardy. The second complication in Afghanistan, which is a big one, in my opinion, is the existence of a safe haven for the Taliban and al-Qaeda in Pakistan. You'll recall the Russian experience, that was their principal problem. They could establish control of any particular piece of Afghanistan, but they could never establish control over the Afghan community that had moved into Pakistan. It was always there. It was always fermenting and full of agitation for carrying on the war. That's where people went and recruited young new fighters. That's where the money came in from throughout the Arab world. I mean, ending that safe haven in Pakistan was absolutely essential to even carrying forward their hopes of winning in Afghanistan, the Russian hopes of winning in Afghanistan, and they never got close because they couldn't, so the world wouldn't let them. Now, the United States is in a somewhat similar situation. We're actually fighting roughly the same people, and they have roughly the same safe haven. And we have an implicit, not quite explicit, an implicit threat on the table, open-ended, that I consider to be the third complication in Afghanistan, to go into the safe haven area and end the freedom of al-Qaeda and the Taliban to operate there if the Pakistanis won't do it. Now, that's a big thing to actually carry through, but years of frustration could bring us to the point where we might actually do that. We do it now in a modest way, as everybody knows, by flying Predator aircraft over the northwest frontier districts and tribal areas, and with modern intelligence means we single out particular houses or structures where we believe Al-Qaeda or Taliban leaders might be, and then we fire what are called hellfire missiles at them. They're extremely accurate, and then they blow up the house. There've been a half a dozen, perhaps, fairly clearly identified and documented cases of that, and they always kill a bunch of people, and we always insist that there were some serious bad guys there, and there's always some women and children too, or just people who happen to be passing by. It's precise in its way, but it's you can't really control a political and religious movement throughout an area, I don't know, twice the size of Connecticut with, you know, a couple of pilotless aircraft and some hellfire missiles. To me, it seems very, very provocative and not efficient, and a very clear example of the military error, where you think you can do with military means what you can't do by political means. The Russians, as everybody remembers, and especially if you've seen Charlie Wilson's War, which I recommend to you, it's a pretty good movie, really ran into trouble when the United States armed the Afghan Mujahideen with Stinger missiles that could bring down their helicopters. And from being almost invulnerable in the air, they went in the space of a week or to being extremely vulnerable and losing very large numbers of aircraft, which are expensive in themselves, with lots of people on board, which are painful to lose in any circumstance. And that really broke their back. And there was nothing they could do about it. I'm sure at the time they must have been incredibly furious at the United States for doing this. There was no secret about where these missiles were coming from. But there wasn't anything they could do. They were just stuck, and they had to take it until they couldn't take it. And when they couldn't take it, they drove back across the Friendship Bridge into Tajikistan. And, you know, we are very helicopter dependent over there. And we are at the mercy of any country that should decide, for whatever reasons might seem good to them, to provide the Afghan rebels with missiles that can bring down our helicopters and put us in a similar kind of a situation. I consider it sort of iffy and dangerous, and it would be very frustrating to us, but what could you do? You'd just be stuck. You can't invade the whole world. You'd have to suffer those things sometimes. So I consider that to be a serious problem. In a way, I think of Afghanistan as being a longer term, more dangerous, more difficult, more intractable situation than the one even that we face in Iraq, partly because they just have such a long history of doing this. The most successful of the many invaders of Afghanistan was Alexander the Great. And I read a recent account of his success, which attributed entirely to the fact that he established a large Greek colony of about 10,000 people who built several large cities, and those colonies grew to some extent. There was a real Greek presence there. It lasted for about 170 years, at the end of which they were all killed. More recently, in the 19th century, the British invaded Afghanistan twice in the late 1830s, 1840. On that occasion, both times they very relatively easily and successfully occupied Kabul, and they thought the problem was resolved. And then things began to get complicated almost immediately in the same kind of way that we're familiar with. These guys don't like you very much. After a while, they realize you aren't as strong as you appeared at first. They begin to find a way to attack you, and they do. And they basically want you to go home. And they go on attacking you until you do go home. And the British for a briefer time, the Russians for a substantial amount of time, and us for a pretty long time already, respond to the people who are killing us to make us go home by killing them so they'll stop killing us to make us go home. It's just, where does that end? I don't see any hope for that. Kipling wrote a poem that includes a line or two. There is rock to the left and rock to the right, and low lean thorn between, and you may hear a breech bolt snick where never a man is seen. And you know, that's what the British faced. The first group in in Afghanistan left after 2 years. There were about 4,000 people in the departing party. One came out, just one, a doctor, I think named William Bryden, who wrote an account of it. And later, a few others did emerge, women and children, and a few people who'd been held captive for a while. But you could hardly call it a success. And in the 1870s, 1878 and 79, I think it was, the British went in there again into Afghanistan and right to Kabul, practically no problem, one victory after another. Queen Victoria was extremely pleased with their success, and then things began to go wrong, and it was a similar kind of history. They just left because there was a lot of trouble, and you got nowhere, and it broke your heart, and it was expensive and pointless. So the new president in January of 2009 is going to be facing that. He's going to be facing an already six-year-old war in Iraq and an already eight-year-old war in Afghanistan. I always thought from the beginning of the war in Iraq that it was going to destroy two presidents. And I thought it was going to destroy the first president by completely absorbing his attention and all the efforts of his administration and prevent them from being able to do anything else, really, until it was over, simply because the war would be so frustrating and so impossible to carry through to a successful conclusion, because you were trying to do with military means things that you can't achieve with an army. And then I figured the second president would be destroyed because he would have been elected in the usual way after an incredible ordeal, rising to the top of the pile, and in that initial euphoria when you've done it and you've actually got all the way to the top and you're first and you've been elected and you're in office, you think, well, I got a few months to think things over and we can do better than those guys because they made the following 17 mistakes, all carefully identified. We're not going to do any of that. There's a temptation to believe that you can fix what other people couldn't. And my feeling is you've only got a very short window of from 3 to 6 months before the war begins to be your war. If you do something then, if you really get out then, I think you might be able to successfully do it, and people will forgive you for the price that it inevitably caused because you didn't start it. It wasn't yours. You're trying to clean up somebody else's mess. But after 3 to 6 months, you've already said quite a few times, oh, I know what to do. This is going to work. Trust me. And pretty soon it's your war. My feeling is that the only way to get out for Clinton or Obama or McCain, if he should happen to see his way clear to that, would be to remove the bandage with one quick yank, as quick as you can, and start out. It will take tremendous resolution and just determination that you're going to do this, this is what you're going to do, and nothing's going to get in the way. And the last time we saw that kind of resolution was when Bush went in. He insisted that he was going to go in. And he completely, he didn't ignore, but he dismissed the consequences. People raised all kinds of objections and opposition. He couldn't get the UN to agree with it. None of our allies were really enthusiastic, with the exception of Tony Blair and Britain, for reasons that remain inexplicable. And he just determined, the entire government, Bush's entire government, insisted there was going to be a regime change in Iraq during an American military occupation, and that we were going to create a new government there, and that's what he was going to do, and he went forward and he made it happen. If you go back and you read about it, it didn't look like it was going to happen until to people who weren't aware of how determined he was and how resolute he was. It didn't look like it would happen until fairly late in the day. There were a lot of people who thought, you know, as late as the 1st of March 2003, that it might still not happen. But he was resolved. He had that kind of resolution, that sort of damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead kind of resolution. I believe it will take that kind of resolution to really turn around, start pulling out of Iraq now. Whether it's possible in Afghanistan now, I doubt. We haven't suffered enough there. We haven't had enough men there long enough, trying hard enough to have really and truly given up. So it's my feeling that 4 years from now, we'll be facing a very similar question. How to get out of Iraq and Afghanistan, only then it will be a 10-year war in Iraq and a 12-year war in Afghanistan, and no clear, decisive result in view. Thank you.
Tom, thanks a lot. We always try to end the questions on an optimistic note. So if somebody's got a question that could be answered in an optimistic note, save it until the end. Ron.
Your Kipling poem had a telling ending to the records about the British soldiers. If they were captured by the Afghans, they would fall on their right and cut off their brain. Kind of people we're dealing with. General Eisenhower, who became President of the United States, had vast experience both in the military and in politics. He wasn't a stupid man. He warned the nation as on leaving office about a military-industrial complex. Is it too cynical to think that we're involved with these wars now to feed that
energy? I've got to repeat the question. The question related to President Eisenhower's warning about the perils of a military-industrial complex. And the question was asking, is this, in fact, what we're facing right now?
Well, there's no question that we certainly have a military-industrial complex and that it absorbs a great deal of the national wealth on an annual basis. But I don't think of that as being exactly the cause of the problem in the most immediate sense. My own feeling is that we have built an extremely flexible and efficient military instrument, and it becomes difficult not to use it when you've already gone ahead and built it and it exists. I remember many years ago when there was talk in the Kennedy administration about going into Laos and in order to settle a political situation there with military means. And it was decided not to do it because we didn't have the transport capacity to send the people over there. And McNamara immediately started a program to build an endless number of large aircraft that could transport an army in a hurry to that part of the world. And he did it, and then we used it in Vietnam. And I think it's sort of that. I believe that Bush and Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld all felt that the military instrument that the United States had built was fully capable of defeating Saddam's army in a short period of time, and they just were not thinking about the consequences afterwards and what would likely be the result. And they're, I think, pretty confident even right now that they have a capacity to more or less go anywhere in Afghanistan, to do anything to anybody, and that we can achieve a political result that way. But I myself am full of skepticism.
We'll start here.
The question is whether the UN has any role, conceivable role, in ending the war in Iraq.
There's no question that if the United States left, or really started to leave, that the presence of the UN would become more useful, become larger. But I don't see how they could push for one or invent one. It depends too heavily on the intentions of the United States. So the UN is always involved in places where there are things to clean up and take care of, but it very rarely precipitates the big movements, and I don't think it could find a way to precipitate a big movement of us out.
In your opinion, is there the remotest chance that a new Congress, for once possibly listening to the people, might refuse to fund further activity in Iraq?
The question is whether a new Congress, unlike past Congresses, might actually refuse to continue funding the war in Iraq.
I would say that there was a remote chance that that could occur. It's happened once before in Vietnam, but it took them 10 years to bring themselves to that point. It's really tough to stand up and say, no, it's over, it didn't work, we're getting out, no more argument, no more money, that's it. And I don't hear that yet. I don't hear anything quite that close. But I would say that it's remotely possible that they might feel that way. And it would depend to a large extent, I think, on how a new president came in. And if it's Clinton and Obama talking about pulling people back out of Iraq or removing some of the troops or starting them out or moving them next door into Kuwait, I think it would be much more difficult, obviously, for the Congress to take a strong stand. But if McCain were to be elected in the Democratic Congress, both houses, perhaps by a large majority, it would be more possible. But still, I just don't feel it yet.
We'll go up here and then we'll go down there. Dick and then Dave. Yeah.
You've drawn a very clear parallel between the experience in Vietnam and where we are in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's clear who lost in Vietnam. It's clear who won and what winning meant. Who would win in this situation if we lose? And what would be the nature of winning?
The question is that in Vietnam, when we lost, it was clear who won, the North Vietnamese. If we were to lose in Iraq, who would be the victor? What would it mean to win? What would it mean to lose?
Well, you put your finger on a big difference between the war in Vietnam and the one we confront now. The enemy is quite different. We're the same. We seem to approach these things in very similar spirit. Our politics seems to get involved in a very similar kind of way. We're already talking about people who are staying the course versus people who want to cut and run, which is the sort of argument that became so bitter in the Vietnam era. Who would actually win is a little bit hard to see in Iraq if we were to actually leave. But I would say at the moment, the party that was closest to being in control and had the most natural resources to getting into control, if left alone by the other countries in the region, would be the Shia, and that they would actually end up in control in Iraq. They wouldn't necessarily be our enemy. They aren't necessarily our enemy now, but they certainly have different priorities and different policies and different instincts than the ones we hoped a new government in Iraq would have. That would it wouldn't be a defeat in quite the same way. The people who are fighting us there don't have the sort of military capacity to conduct a Tet offensive or to fight very large-scale operations, but they have the capacity to go on forever. That's the one thing we can't stand.
Dave, did you have one? And then Bob. Yeah.
Given the fact that the forces are overstretched and likely to remain so for some time to come, can we go forward without avoiding a draft? And if, in fact, we did institute a draft, would that change the public attitude to it?
The question is about the fact that the military, the American military, is currently overstretched, and therefore is it likely if we do continue that we end up reinstating the draft, and if we were to do so, what impact would that have?
I don't see how we could reinstate a draft at this point. If we had a draft and it was a conscript army that had been sent in there in the beginning, then the tendency of the people at large to support the troops would be even more pronounced than it is now, I think. So I don't think we could put a draft into effect at this point. And the Pentagon doesn't talk about that. What they talk about is doing it the way they've done it up till now with money. They pay people a lot, and they pay them a lot to re-enlist when their initial enlistments are up, and they pay they spend a lot of money trying to recruit kids into the Army, and they feel they can actually expand the Army. All we have to do, from their point of view, all the Congress has to do is to authorize the additional monies for an expansion of the military. At the moment now, they've got a program in effect, I think, to expand it by 90,000 men, which is not really a huge number compared to the numbers that we might actually need. The cost of it, you know, is going to be big. And whether you can continue to pay for all of this by not paying for it, borrowing the money, and not raising taxes to actually fund it, I don't see how you can do that. And raising the taxes is going to be very painful. So there are the choices are painful from a political point of view for anybody who's president, but it just takes a lot of resolution to just bite the bullet and leave.
Inability of these three different career groups to work together
Yeah, it's an interesting question. As we all know, if you do polls, you find out that the American military rates very high in the opinion of the American public compared to Congress and a lot of other institutions. And the question is, how would, because I don't think anybody's ever seen polls on this, how would the Foreign Service or the intelligence agencies rate in the American public's mind, and what is the relationship between the military, the Foreign Service, the intelligence agencies, and the relative value that the American public sees of each of the three?
I don't get any feeling that the public is blaming the military for the problems there. In fact, the public, to me, seems to have a fairly sophisticated idea that there was blinkered thinking in the Pentagon and the Office of the Secretary of Defense and in the White House, and that they made fundamental errors of the kind that an army can never make right again afterwards. If you don't send them in with enough people, then there are not enough people there, and they can't take secure control of the country on day one or day two or day three, and the kind of problems that have followed will follow. So I don't feel that they would blame the military. And the question of the intelligence services is more complicated. I mean, they certainly got blamed for the WMD fiasco, although I felt that the way that blame was apportioned was inaccurate, did not actually represent the nature of the problem. The nature of the problem is that American intelligence services, like those of other countries, are very beholden to the chief executive. It's very hard for them to resist delivering the kind of information that the chief executive needs in order to make the case for what it is he wants to do. And you had to have a case, some kind of case, to invade Iraq, and the case that they chose was the danger of Saddam's weapons of mass destruction, and the intelligence community went along with it in the way that they find it almost impossible not to go along. So they've been blamed for that. But one of the odd things here is that it seems to me that people do blame the Congress for being passive and for just taking it and not being skeptical enough in the beginning. Certainly, I mean, the thing I find among Democrats is that they're furious at the Congress for being so passive and so lacking in skepticism before the initial vote for the war. And since taking control of both houses of Congress, they feel very disappointed that there hasn't been a more aggressive kind of probing into the reasons for the war and the conduct of the war and the possible consequences of the war. And it would have been very useful for a president coming into office to have had the public already thoroughly educated and brought up to speed on some of the issues that would be involved with either going forward or getting out, which hasn't happened. I do think people feel disappointed and express little confidence in the Congress. And, you know, the new president will enjoy a honeymoon, I'm sure. They all do. But if he can't deal with this problem, it's going to end up being just as big as it was for Bush. It'll just suck up all the energy of a new administration. And their hopes of doing other things will become much more difficult or dashed entirely. Are we come to the optimistic point yet? Or?
Not yet. All right. We've got some questions down here. Yeah.
My question was answered.
Okay. Well, we got one. Yeah. Yeah. And then Charlie, and then John.
I think many of us feel the way you just stated, that whatever happened to Congress, especially when the Democrats became the majority, what could you help us understand what this phenomenon is?
It's a follow-up question, which is, all right, the Democrats took over Congress. What went wrong? Why were they unable? Why were they so ineffective in dealing with a war that they had been against?
I don't know. I've wondered a lot about that myself. I think that to some extent, they seem to have been a little bit afraid of getting it wrong, that if you get on the wrong side of a national security issue, you could just have a career destroyed in an afternoon by making the wrong statement or the wrong remark. They seem to be a little gun-shy and a little nervous in that department. And then they seem to have taken a decision to stick to one or two big questions, like funding the war, setting a date certain for the beginning of the withdrawal, things like that that beg all the argument, just say, let's assume it was a mistake. Here's what we want you to do. Get out. And not discuss all the difficult points. But I feel there may be a third reason, and that is the argument is a complex one, and it pulls in all different bodies of opinion, and there's a lot of argument about how to make the Middle East safe for the United States, safe for Israel, safe for the world. It's a lot of argument about, well, how do you really deal with the oil? Do you actually need to have some kind of physical control over that oil in order to be assured of buying it, or not? And if you start talking about that in public, people will start to argue in a violent way. And I feel the Democrats are gun-shy of having a frank discussion.
Charlie, and then we'll come back to you.
You've sort of stayed away from one word that's kind of big in the presidential debates, that of diplomacy and negotiation. Negotiation and diplomacy were not a big part of the current administration's way of approaching these issues. The Democratic challengers are debating about how negotiation should be used. What future do you see, if any, for negotiation and diplomacy in settling these situations?
Yeah, the question is there any future for negotiation and diplomacy in dealing with Iraq and Afghanistan, finding a solution?
Well, tidying up the pieces at the very end, yes, there's always a place for negotiation and diplomacy when you get to that. But first you have to make those big decisions. Are you going to go on fighting or not? Are you going to maintain a military presence there or not? Are you going to bring those troops home or not? And those are, they have to come first at this stage. Iraq is a complex political phenomenon. And if we left, I don't think Al-Qaeda would take over or Osama bin Laden would be the next president or anything remotely like that. But there'd be a government there we weren't that keen on. And very likely if we left, we would not leave with permission of the government to maintain a large and enduring military presence. And we don't want that. And we could not hope for any guarantee that they would keep Iran at arm's length and not become an ally of Iran in the Middle East in some way. So we're, in a sense, sort of negotiating with ourselves. We have to come to a kind of a clear decision of how much lack of control we're now willing to live with. I mean, typically, you have to live with a lot of lack of control. And the military error is to come under the persuasion that you can control things that you can't, actually. And you have to get rid of that. You have to abandon this notion of control. Then negotiation and politics comes back to the fore.
I'm just curious, with your expertise in the current status of the world and the conflicts and the insurgencies, it seems like you'd be a likely candidate for some light reading. But you're working on a book on the Oglala Lakota and the Crazy Horse. Are you seeing collectives or correlations and parallels in the 19th century?
Maybe we should save that one. That sounds like the optimistic one. Can we come back to that?
Sure.
Mark.
I think the comment was made that if we leave, the Shias would actually be in charge, and they don't have the military prowess to do anything here. But without the military prowess, do they have the ideological prowess to do things and change things here?
Here? In the United States?
United States.
The Shia having the...
Well, through infiltration of their thoughts here by, in other words, a reversal, essentially, of the Crusades.
Okay, so the question is, if we were to leave, would the Shia have the military or political prowess to be a danger?
Not the military, but their ideology, the
triad.
Their ideology here.
Would their ideology here have any negative effect in terms of the United States?
I don't think so. But I do think that a strong working relationship between Shia Iraq and Shia Iran could have a lot of influence in the Middle East. That would be a powerful combination. Two large countries with a lot of oil wealth at their disposal, that would be a powerful thing. And then that might challenge American interests or American friends in the region. Certainly Israel does not want to see any such thing. They find that very alarming and troubling, especially if Iran were to succeed in developing nuclear weapons. But for the Shia to make a major intellectual or religious inroads in the United States would require profound transformation of America, and I can hardly imagine. I mean, I just don't see that at all.
All right, we've got time. All right, we'll do here, and then we'll come back to the Indian question.
On a positive note, have we had any successes in rebuilding Iraq's infrastructure?
I'm not sure that's a positive note.
The question is, have we had any successes in terms of rebuilding the Iraqi infrastructure?
Well, kind of, sort of, a little. I believe that we have now restored oil production back to the level, roughly the level it was when we went to war. So we're back there. And there's been a lot of money spent on sewage systems and things of that kind. But, I mean, whenever I read anything about that, it seems very ineffective. And the money poorly spent and projects left half completed. And sometimes I can see you have a follow-up. What about water and electricity? The places that have been having trouble with water and electricity still have trouble with water and electricity. I think they have more electricity than they used to, but it's not like you can turn on a light in any part of Baghdad at any time of the day or night and expect it to go on. I mean, there's big chunks of time when it just doesn't work, and it's not efficient. So I don't think that's a big plus, and I don't think we can call that the positive note on which we would like to end.
Okay, so here's a positive note on which we would like to end. The question is, as you recall from the introduction, Tom is writing a book about Crazy Horse, who was the Sioux chief, one of the Sioux chiefs at the Battle of the Little Bighorn when Custer was killed. And the questioner is wondering if there's any relation between the Indian Wars, what's the connection in his own mind between the Indian Wars of the 19th century and what's going on in Iraq now.
Make that positive.
I'll do my best. I got to tell you, I love those Indians. And I love reading about them, and I love meeting them and talking to them out in Pine Ridge in South Dakota now. And I love trying to bring back together a vivid portrait of the way they were and of that particular moment of transition, which was, God knows, difficult for them when they went in the space of a year or two from being free-roaming buffalo hunters to wards of the state on confined Indian agencies and throughout the West on generally not very ideal parcels of land. You did ask if it bore any relationship to anything else I've ever studied, and when I started, I wasn't anticipating that particularly. But, you know, Crazy Horse was killed while the U.S. Army was trying to place him under arrest so they could ship him to Florida. And there was a guy involved there named William Philo Clark, a lieutenant, fresh out of West Point. And I hadn't spent very much time studying Clark before I felt I recognized a distinctive American type of the sort that went to Vietnam and tried to make it work there. He had a confidence that he could work the Indians, that he could get them to do what he wanted, and that he could control them. And very soon he discovered that wasn't the case, and he couldn't do it. And the circumstances that led to the death of Crazy Horse involved a great deal of secret conversations and hugger-mugger behind the scenes that has a very familiar feel. It's like a classic American clandestine operation. The way the people talk to each other, what it is they've got in mind to achieve, how they're going to do it, it's very familiar. So I guess that's not optimistic exactly, but I would, on an optimistic note, which I feel required to deliver, somebody once complained to Adam Smith that if such and such happened in Britain, it would be the ruin of the nation. And Adam Smith said, well, there's a great deal of ruin in a nation. And it's true. They don't fall in a minute. They don't come apart at the seams, and they're not destroyed easily. And ours is a very strong nation. And one of the reasons why I believe we can leave Iraq is that we're strong enough to suffer that kind of a short-term failure and humiliation, rise above it, and again take up a position where we're a credit to ourselves and a joy to the world.
Well said. Great.
Well, hey, Tom, it was a great talk, and you certainly delivered on the optimism at the end. We appreciate that. For those of you who are interested, some of two of Tom's books are available here, and he can certainly sign them if you want him to. Usually, we have the famous Mid-Coast Forum on Foreign Relations mug that we give to our speakers, but Sarah forgot to bring it this time. The check is in the mail. We'll send it. Hey, many thanks, Tom.
My pleasure.